Oh God. okay, that was really amazing. I just kind of need to say that I've only had a few hours sleep for the last two nights. And I came here with this sort of fantasy that I'd be able to just work on this talk and make something really good while I was here. And it just hasn't really happened. And I'm not trying to sort of put myself down. I'm just... it's been a sort of struggle. I don't know. Like, basically, passion and beauty have been actually happening sort of here in the moment, you know? And I've just felt like I had to sort of respond to what was actually happening, you know, rather than just sit in my tent the entire time writing this talk, you know? So I apologise that it is not up to my sort of usual standard, but, like, I don't know, sometimes you just have to be alive to what's actually happening, you know? So it's been, I've had quite a lot of suffering here and a lot of beauty, and I've been really loved and healed and, you know, probably the same as all of you. So anyway, I just finished writing this about 40 minutes ago and I quickly read through it and I just thought, oh my God. But anyway, so I'll just read what I've got. Some of it's good, but there's other bits where you sort of think, what was she on about? So anyway. So the other thing is I'm not very I haven't rehearsed it. So that thing where you normally sort of just glance down and then look up, I'm not going to be doing that. So I'm just going to be going, what's the next bit? So anyway, I'm going to start off with a poem by Charles Bukowski. And then we'll see what sort of unfolds from there. Your life is your life. Don't let it be clubbed into dank submission. Be on the watch. There are ways out. There is a light somewhere. It may not be much light, but it beats the darkness. Be on the watch. The gods will offer you chances. Know them. Take them. You can't beat death, but you can beat death in life sometimes. And the more often you learn to do it, the more light there will be. Your life is your life. Know it while you have it. You are marvellous. The gods wait to delight in you. So, my talk is kind of about wanting to live a passionate life. How can we lead a passionate life and still keep the precepts? So, quick joke. Master, how can we become enlightened? Answer. By abstaining from sex, alcohol and drugs. Is there someone else we can ask? So, I have to admit, when I saw that the theme for Buddhafield was radical simplicity, my immediate response was, oh my God, that sounds really boring. But being an individualist, I thought, well, I'll just write a talk about whatever I want to write a talk about, you know. But as I started making notes for it, I realised that passion and simplicity are not as separate as they may sound. So I grew up in a small town in the 70s. As a young child, it was quite stimulating because it was the countryside and there were sort of rivers and streams and... This was in the days when your mum would just sort of like kick you out in the morning and sort of let you back in at tea time. So we had quite a lot of freedom. And I was always sort of very into nature. And at the age of about four, I had a spontaneous spiritual experience. I was playing in the garden with my sister and I just suddenly got a strange feeling come over me, a bit like a sort of calling. And I stood up and the whole sky was just on fire with this most amazing sunset. And what had happened was I'd lost that kind of division, that sort of like subject-object divide. So normally in life, well, speaking for myself, we experience ourselves as a self sort of in here and in everything else kind of out there. But that isn't the way things really are. And so at the age of four, I had this experience where this subject-object divide was suddenly gone and everything was shining, everything was somehow made of love. And I used to refer to this experience as the oneness. So we'll come back to this later. As an older child, I found the town I lived in actually quite constraining. There was no kind of higher thought or spirituality, and there wasn't really any access to decent drugs. And I wanted to take drugs from actually quite an early age, probably from the age of about 11 or 12, because I wanted to expand my consciousness. So I'd read about these sort of altered states in this biography of the Beatles that I got from the library, and I just really wanted to take LSD. So, though my drug taking actually started out with quite a noble motivation, this soon evaporated once I discovered the joy of getting completely twatted. You know? And I stopped sort of waiting for this occasional bit of really nice hash to come along, and I just gravitated to sort of sniffing glue and drinking Strongbow. Sort of classy dame. To be honest, I partly blame the Ramblers Association. My parents were in the Ramblers, okay? And so that meant that every other Sunday, my sister and I would sort of like be dragged for sort of endless, endless miles, you know, across sort of countryside, you know, sort of like endless fields of like under barbed wire fences and over cattle fences and sort of across streams and, you know, even the odd river. and in the heat of summer, when you're like sort of 9 or 10, you know, this was just sort of like a kind of hell realm, you know. But halfway, we would stop at a pub, and then I'd get this pint of shandy. And what began to happen was that I sort of started to symbolise this pint as hope, you know, the sort of end to my suffering. So I'd be trudging through these fields of like hour after hour, you know, sort of like, it's kind of like occasionally getting sort of zapped back into consciousness by a sort of badly straddled cattle fence, you know. There's nothing like an unexpected zap of electricity to the snatch to really wake you up. And I'd be sort of visualising this point, you know, kind of like the Holy Grail sort of emerging from the blue sky, sort of beads of dew running down it, you know. Sort of, you know, and by the time I was 17, I was an alcoholic, you know. So what began as a search for more sort of aliveness became the total opposite. Because as well as having a really strong longing for beauty and truth, I was also, you know, really wounded, and I wanted to avoid my pain. So ultimately, this kind of quest to avoid my pain kind of actually brought me to Buddhism. You know, it was a bit of a desperate act, actually, coming to the Buddhist centre. It's a bit like the sort of state you go into when you go to a 12-step group for the first time. You know, you sort of hit rock bottom, and I couldn't think what else to do because my life was just falling apart. You know, so I just thought, well, you know, a weird cult, you know, sort of give it a shot. And not long after I started going to the Brighton Buddhist Centre, I came across three amazing things. So one was Buddhafield. Buddhafield began running retreats about 6 months after I learnt to meditate. So this was about, I don't know, 23 years or so ago. Another was Sangharakshita's lecture on the Heart Sutra. So listening to this lecture on the Heart Sutra made me realise that this childhood experience of the oneness was actually where Buddhism could take me. And most importantly, I came across the Bodhisattva vow. So the Bodhisattva vow. The Bodhisattva, Bodhi meaning, what's that mean, enlightenment, and sattva meaning being. So the bodhisattva is one who strives to gain enlightenment for the sake of all that lives, for all beings. And when I came across that, I just knew that that was the real meaning in life. But I would never find anything that was higher than that and more noble than that. But I wasn't very integrated, and practicing Buddhism was actually very challenging. So I mentioned the precepts, you know, how can we lead a passionate life and keep the precepts? So the precepts in Buddhism are a set of ethical training principles. And there are five precepts which are common throughout Buddhism. So in their negative formulation, these five precepts are 1, I undertake to abstain from taking life. 2, I undertake to abstain from taking the not given. 3. I undertake to abstain from sexual misconduct. 4. I undertake to abstain from false speech. And 5. I undertake to abstain from taking intoxicants. So I can remember hearing these 5 precepts for the first time and sort of thinking, you know, sort of one, you know, like abstaining from taking life, great. You know, I mean, I was already vegetarian, been vegetarian since I was 14. I was just about to become vegan. And so 2, not stealing, you know, that was a bit, that was, I mean, I was an occasional shoplifter still at that time, but I thought, well, you know, fair enough, I'll give it a crack. So 3, sexual misconduct, 4, false speech, I thought, okay, and then 5, abstaining from taking intoxicants. And I thought, I'm not sure about this. In fact, not only was I not sure, but I just actually didn't bother trying. And luckily, my friend, Vishwadarkani, who I met on my introductory meditation course, she didn't really bother trying either. In fact, I remember being on our, after our first pre-mitra group. Yeah. I remember we went out to, and she bought some white cider. And we sort of went to the children's play park in the dark. And she was sort of like staggering around in the sandpit. And I was sort of like, oh, what are you doing? And she goes, I'm making a sand mandala. I have to say it wasn't very good. And that's one of the many reasons that I love Vishwadarkani. So the positive formulation of the 5th precept is, with mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my mind. And mindfulness didn't really appeal to me very much either. But that's because I had a wrong view of what mindfulness actually is. I think mindfulness, to me, sounded a bit sort of dry, you know, like, oh, I'm going to be very mindful, you know, sort of like a kind of alienated awareness. But actually, mindfulness is something deeply beautiful. So I'm going to read you a quote now by the photographer Ansel Adams. I don't know if you know Ansel Adams. He takes these very took these very beautiful photos. And for me, this quote really expresses what mindfulness is. So this is Ansel Adams. I was climbing the long ridge west of Mount Clark. It was one of those mornings where the sunlight is burnished with a keen wind and long feathers of cloud move in a lofty sky. The silver light turned every blade of grass and every particle of sand into a luminous metallic splendour. There was nothing, however small, that did not clash in the bright wind, that did not send arrows of light through the glassy air. I was suddenly arrested in the long crunching path up the ridge by an exceedingly pointed awareness of the light. The moment I paused, the full impact of the mood was upon me. I saw more clearly than I've ever seen before or since the minute details of the grasses, the small flotsam of the forest, the motion of the high clouds streaming above the peaks. I dreamed that for a moment time stood quietly, and the vision became but the shadow of an infinitely greater world, and I had within the grasp of consciousness a transcendental experience. So Buddhism may not sound at first like a path of passion, but that is exactly what it is. Buddhism is about becoming more fully alive. So in the Dhammapada it says, mindfulness is the way to the immortal, unmindfulness the way to death. Those who are mindful do not die, whereas the unmindful are like the dead. So mindfulness is the way to the immortal, being fully present in the eternal moment. So just to go a little bit Matrix here, you know, time is an illusory construct, you know. There is just the eternal moment, you know. Things aren't unfolding through time or changing over time. Things are just unfolding and changing. In fact, there aren't actually any things to unfold. There is only unfolding and changing. There are seasons and cycles, you know, such as day and night, but those aren't time. Those are just changes that occur in dependence on conditions. So mindfulness, the eternal moment. So it's like the summer holidays when you're a child. Those 6 or 7 weeks just seem to stretch on forever because you're in the present moment. You're not caught up with the past or the future. Unmindfulness is the way to death. The unmindful are like the dead. So anyone who's sat on the internet all day will know exactly what this feels like. And YouTube will kindly remind you of where you have been squandering your precious life in the form of recommendations based on your recent viewing. So I knew that when Mormon serial killers came up that I had not been making the most of my existence. No. And then you have notifications. So-and-so likes your comment, not since Millie Vanilli split up. That is actually one of my real ones. So, I don't know if you've seen The League of Gentlemen. Charles and Stella. Stella, have you ever thought of having a threesome? Not since Millie Vanilli split up. So we've mentioned the transcendental. And I thought it might be worth looking on the internet for some succinct definitions. But I didn't really find any. What I did get when I typed in the word transcendental, somewhat alarmingly, was a big picture of David Lynch. and a quote, "The thing about meditation is you become more you, David Lynch." So I don't know if that's appealing or off-putting. So here's a few of the definitions I found of the transcendental. Transcendental, concerned with the a priori or intuitive basis of knowledge as independent of experience. Beyond common thought or experience, mystical or supernatural. Beyond our experience of phenomena, although not beyond potential knowledge. The best one, though, was from the Urban Dictionary. Sounded like it had been written by Bill and Ted. You know, it said, so transcendental, it said, although previously taken as a way of thinking in the 1800s, especially by people such as Thoreau, the modern way of perceiving the word transcendental can be redefined. Someone is transcendental when he or she is a freaking boss, beast, or pro. Someone who transcends is someone who can go beyond even the highest level of skill. Person one, dude, check out that kid, he's such a beast. Person two, nah mang, he's better than that, he's transcendental. So, and as I was typing in meaning of transcendental, these other sort of search results for meaning of came up. One of the highest ones was meaning of life. And I just couldn't resist having a look, okay? Because passion in life is really about meaning in life. Passion, real passion, is what gives life meaning. So here's a few of those results. The answer to what is the meaning of life pertains to the significance of living, or existence in general. Many other related questions included are, why are we here? What is life all about? What is the purpose of existence? There have been a large number of proposed answers to these questions. So here's a few quotes from the answer section. Edgar Allan Poe. The best things in life make you sweaty. Albert Camus. The literal meaning of life is whatever you're doing that prevents you from killing yourself. And Kurt Vonnegut. Plato says the unexamined life is not worth living. But what if the examined life turns out to be a clunker as well? And Alan Watts, existence is quite weird. So having found meaning in life quotes, the internet offered me life is cruel and painful quotes. And it was in this section that I found a quote from Buddhism, which is... The noble truth of suffering is this. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrows and lamentation, pain, grief and despair are suffering. Association with the unpleasant, suffering. Disassociation with the pleasant, can you guess? Suffering. Not to get what one wants, suffering. In short, the five aggregates of attachment are suffering. So that is a pretty thorough list, although it doesn't mention camping next to someone with a ukulele. So. That somewhat unuplifting Buddhist quote mentioned the five aggregates. And the five aggregates, or the five skandhas, make up that into which the whole of conditioned phenomenal existence is divided. So, namely, material form, feeling or emotion, perception, volitional activities, and consciousness. And the transcendental is that which exists outside of conditioned phenomenal existence. So probably the best definition from those I found on the internet was the one that said, the transcendental is beyond our experience of phenomena, although not beyond potential knowledge. So the real meaning in life is the transcendental. The real passion in life is enlightenment. It is the unenlightened existence that is suffering. Because in the unenlightened state, we experience life in terms of this subject-object divide, a me in here and an everything else out there, and that is not the truth. And all the while the separation exists, we will experience suffering. So I'm not saying that we can't experience happiness this side of enlightenment. You know, of course we can experience happiness. But there will always be a part of us that remains unfulfilled. And into this bottomless pit we will pour alcohol and drugs and the internet and our iPhones, and nothing will ever be enough. And all the while we experience ourselves as a self, there exists the potential for greed and hatred, you know, attachment and aversion. So let's look a little bit about at what enlightenment actually is. So wisdom in Buddhism, enlightenment is a synthesis of wisdom and compassion. And so the wisdom has quite a specific meaning in Buddhism, and it is very much about this subject-object divide. So we experience ourselves as a self in here, and everything else out there. And in reality, no such separation exists. We talk about no self in Buddhism, or going beyond the self. But that isn't to say that we're trying to get rid of something. It's more that we come to realise that it never existed in the first place. So if we think about the things that we normally attach this idea of a self to, so our thoughts, our feelings and our bodies, we don't have to look for very long to see that none of these things exist separately from so-called outside conditions. So if we look at each of these in turn, well, I don't know about you, but my body seems quite obviously beyond my control. It just kind of does what it wants, you know. It gets hungry, whether I want it to or not. Currently, it's aging in ways that I prefer it not to. And the body is very obviously dependent on outside conditions. You know, the body is dependent on oxygen, on food and water. And the existence of food and water and oxygen are all dependent on conditions. So, for example, half the Earth's oxygen comes from plankton. So the body is quite clearly not the self. If I look at my feelings, well, these are, you know, quite obviously also not a self, you know. I feel independence on the so-called outside world. I feel in response to the world, you know, and that includes memories. My feelings don't exist separately from the world. And as for thoughts, well, these are even more obviously products of long chains of conditions. I mean, you just have to look at what your mind does in meditation to be able to see this. Here's a recent one of mine. So I sit down to meditate. I start thinking about teaching meditation here at Buddhafield. As I'm thinking about teaching at Buddhafield, I start thinking about the retreat that I'm going to lead after this. So already this chain started to develop, you know. It's just sort of going along by itself. So I'm thinking, oh, and after this I'm going to be leading a retreat. And then I sort of recollect, you know, with horror, that I'm going to miss the first episode of the new season of Game of Thrones, you know. And then, yeah, I know. The sacrifices we make for the Dharma. And, yeah, and then I start thinking about Game of Thrones. And it's sort of half an hour later, I've gone from how I'm going to lead the Metta Bhavana to this, like, really complex sexual fantasy about Jamie Lannister, you know. So thought is a bit like a computer. Like you type something in and it just finds associations, you know, which some of which may be quite obscure, like Mormon serial killers, you know. And then, of course, we have directed thinking. So you can think, well, you know, I can direct my thoughts. Maybe that's the self, you know. But again, these sort of so-called decisions are parts of really complex webs of conditions, you know. So our decision to come to this festival, for example, well, that decision had to be made with... this festival already had to be in existence. Buddhafield already had to be in existence for us to be able to make a decision to come, you know. Perhaps we came because we have an interest in spirituality. Well, you know, that's another condition that led to that decision, you know. Whatever it was that led to us having an interest in spirituality, that's another link in the chain. It just goes back and back and back. The decision's just like one point in a whole web of interconnections. So then we can maybe think, you know, perhaps awareness itself. Maybe awareness is self. But again, you know, can you decide when to be aware or not, you know? Or is it more true to say that it is just happening? So in the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara says, form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Feeling, thought and choice, consciousness itself are the same as this. So what are these things empty of? They're empty of a self. So the Diamond Sutra puts it like this. As stars, a fault of vision. As a lamp, a mock show. Dewdrops or a bubble. A dream, a lightning flash or cloud. So should one view what is conditioned. So I like to use the example of a rainbow. So a rainbow very clearly demonstrates the way in which so-called things arise. So you have sun, you have rain, and a rainbow arises. So if you take away one of those conditions, so the sun goes behind a cloud, the rainbow ceases to exist. So it's not that it was never real, it's just that it was never a separately existing thing. And everything has this same nature. So that's a little bit about the wisdom aspect of Buddhism. The compassion aspect is much more mysterious. When there is no subject-object duality, what arises is compassion. Love arises. Reality is love. And logically, of course, this doesn't seem true, you know, because we look around and the world is filled with suffering and injustice. You know, even here in this beautiful place, you know, we humans are mainly having a good time. But the living beings all around us, you know, the birds and the insects and the other creatures, every day they're just battling to survive another day, to find enough food and to not be eaten, you know. We don't have to look very far to see suffering. That shaker's really put me off. There's a shaker outside. Okay, so we don't have to look very far to be able to find suffering. But somehow it's still true that everything is love. So this is why we must treasure our vision. We must treasure our glimpses of perfect vision. You know, perfect vision as in like the way that Ansel Adams describes seeing the world. And our vision can arise really at kind of at any time. So It can arise in the face of suffering. It can arise in the presence of great beauty, through meditation, even through drugs. Something can happen whereby suddenly there is no sense of separation between ourselves and everything else. And this is the truth. And when this happens, we know it's the truth. You know that you'll never know anything more true than that. So one formulation of the Buddhist path is vision and transformation. So the Noble Eightfold Path. On the basis of our perfect vision, we transform our whole lives to bring every aspect of our lives in accord with our vision. Unenlightened existence is known as samsara. An enlightened existence is known as nirvana. And these aren't two separate places. They're just two different ways of perceiving the same reality. So it's a bit like in The Last Kingdom. Uhtred explains that heaven is the same as Valhalla, but without all the drinking, fighting and humping. So we talk about the Buddhist path, but no two paths are going to be alike. And I think that it's easy to think that if you practice Buddhism, you know, everyone is going to become sort of very quiet and very peaceful and just sort of wanting to serve. And of course, we all do become more quiet and more peaceful, and we all do want to serve. But as David Lynch sort of rightly says, the thing about meditation is it makes you more you. So there's a parable in the White Lotus Sutra, the parable of the rain cloud or the parable of the plants. So this tells that just as the rain falls equally on all the plants, and yet each plant grows in accord with its own nature, so too the rain of the Dharma falls equally on all beings, and yet each being grows in accord with its own nature. So we just looked at how there was no self. So if there's no self, how can we grow in accord with our own nature? Well, you know, a plant has no self, and yet a plant grows in accord with its own nature. So I'll tell you what happened to me. This is what happened to me in trying to practice the Dharma, Buddhism. I've always been very inspired by Buddhism since I came across it, and particularly by the Bodhisattva vow. But one day I just kind of woke up and I just realised that I'd sort of allowed parts of myself to starve. I can remember the exact moment, actually. It was on a Buddha field retreat, and we had this one particularly dark tarp. Do you remember the dark tarp? Yeah, and when it was damp, it was the dark, damp tarp. And I can just remember, like, sitting in this meditation space, and I just opened my eyes, and I looked around at everyone sitting there with their eyes shut, and I just thought, what am I doing here, you know? and so I left Buddhafield. And the problem wasn't Buddhafield. The problem was it just wasn't my path. It just couldn't meet all of me. So I left Buddhafield and I had a complete meltdown. And I basically sort of became an alcoholic. And I took an overdose, which didn't work, obviously. So I kind of came round from taking all these pills, and my life was just completely in tatters. And I remember the exact moment when I decided to take these pills. It wasn't a big sort of kind of like grief story. I wasn't sort of, you know, oh God, you know, 'cause I'm used to feeling like that, you know, felt like that most of my life. This was just like when you sort of get to the end and you just sort of, I just remember thinking to myself, oh, I'm not doing this again tomorrow. You know, I just thought, I'm not doing this again tomorrow. And it was with no more passion than you'd think, I must go and take the rubbish out, you know. Apart from I was the rubbish that I was going to take out, you know. It was just as simple as that. So I took all these pills, and they didn't kill me. And I came round and I was sort of tripping my tits off, and I thought my kettle was playing a rock and roll station, and I kind of knew that it couldn't be, but it was so good that I couldn't stop listening, you know. And then I ended up in hospital, and and that was the sort of beginning of my kind of like coming back, but with all of me, you know, coming back to the Dharma, but with all of me. So I became an artist, I became a singer, I had a child, you know, became a photographer. Because the problems were, firstly, I thought I could bypass my pain somehow. by practicing Buddhism. And secondly, I just wasn't being true to myself, you know. I had this vision of what I should be like, and it just wasn't happening. But this avoidance of pain had sort of started, you know, in quite early childhood with the sort of drinking and the drugs, and just sort of gone on and on, you know. And this idea that you can practice spirituality and not feel pain is just a lie, you know. So my favourite quote from The Thin Red Line, it's a living soldier looking down at a dead soldier, and you kind of hear the dead soldier's thoughts sort of through narration. Are you righteous, kind? Does your confidence lie in this? Are you loved by all? Know that I was too. Do you imagine your sufferings will be less because you loved goodness, truth? And this is a quote from a poem by Sangharakshita called A Veil of Stars. He must pass beneath the arch of pain who desires to enter into the shrine of love. He must enter into the shrine of love who seeks to gaze upon the face of the image of wisdom. So I kind of wanted to become this person who had no suffering and who was sort of really refined and quiet and really nice, you know. But I just wasn't really like that, you know. The truth is, you know, as Joan Jett said, you know, I love rock and roll, you know. And, you know, my idea of rock and roll isn't a Sangha music evening, you know. Sort of everyone's sort of sitting around with barley cup and a shaker, you know. And my idea of rock and roll also isn't sort of sex and drugs and living an unmindful, death-like existence, you know. What's that mean? 5 minutes? Blimey, I'm going to have to really speed up. So by rock and roll, I mean sort of decaying buildings, broken glass, you know, the passion that comes up from the earth, you know. Lorca wrote about the duende, you know, a mysterious power which everyone senses and no philosopher can explain, which one must awaken in the remotest mansions of the blood. You know, I love the beauty in brokenness, you know, the cracks that let the light shine through. I don't just love the light, I love the cracks as well, you know. The cracks are holy, they're tender and beautiful. The wounds are the portals of beauty, and I love the wounds, you know. When we see brokenness and decay, we see truth, and truth is beauty. So, just as an aside, during my meltdown period, I was at Butterfield, it's about 15 years ago, and I'd been up all night sort of drinking and doing mushrooms, and I was sort of staggering around the site the next morning trying to find my tent, and I accidentally sort of stumbled into a dome where there was a meeting of order members, and they all sort of turned to look at me, and I sort of looked at them and I said, you know, I really love you all, but you're a right bunch of bastards for not recommending me for ordination. So, obviously, really unskillful, but I actually do still treasure the looks on their faces. So, I said that simplicity and passion are maybe not so different. And a few years back, I had this experience where I actually thought there was something really wrong with me. I thought I had a problem with my lungs, and it turned out it was just sort of a bit of asthma. But there was a period of about sort of 6 months to a year where I just thought, God, you know, maybe there was something really wrong with me. And because I've got my daughter, I was like terrified, you know. And during that period of my life, if someone had asked me, what's your dearest wish? I'd have just said, well, to be here now, you know. For me, passion, I realised that passion was just being alive in the eternal moment, you know. My joy is to look upon my daughter when she sleeps, you know. The way the light looks on her hair, and she's like this sort of porcelain angel with sort of hair like flames. And, you know, she'll wake up and she'll look at me and she'll just see me looking at her. And there'll be this moment where she just sees the love in my face, and there'll be like a kind of question on her face that can never be answered. And she's just this very beautiful mystery, you know. You know, life is this very beautiful mystery, you know. And I want to be awake. So I'm going to end with two quotes. They're both quite long, so they won't fit on the tape. But I'm going to read them both because I think they're both really good. And one is another by Charles Bukowski. And the other one is from Dennis Potter, when he was dying. Okay, so first of all, Bukowski. If you're going to try, go all the way. Otherwise, don't even start. This could mean losing girlfriends, wives, relatives, and maybe even your mind. It could mean not eating for 3 or 4 days. It could mean freezing on a park bench. It could mean jail. It could mean derision. It could mean mockery, isolation. Isolation is the gift. All the others are a test of your endurance, of how much you really want to do it. And you'll do it, despite rejection and the worst odds. And it'll be better than anything you can imagine. If you're going to try, go all the way. There is no other feeling like it. You will be alone with the gods, and the nights will flame with fire. You will ride life straight to perfect laughter. It's the only good fight there is. And so this one's Dennis Potter. This is Dennis Potter when he's dying. At this season, the blossom is out in full now. There in the west early. It's a plum tree. It looks like apple blossom, but it's white. And looking at it, instead of saying, oh, that's nice blossom, last week looking at it through the window when I'm writing, I see it is the whitest, frothiest, blossomest blossom that ever could be, and I can see it. Things are more trivial than they ever were, and more important than they ever were. And the difference between the trivial and the important doesn't seem to matter. But the nowness of everything is absolutely wondrous. And if people could see that, you know, there's no way of telling you. You have to experience it. But the glory of it, if you like the comfort of it, not that I'm in the comfort of it, the reassurance, not that I'm interested in reassuring people, bugger that. The fact is, if you see the present tense, boy, do you see it, and boy, can you celebrate it. Your life is your life. Know it while you have it. You are marvellous. The gods wait to delight in you. Thank you.